Well met, and welcome to episode 26 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 3rd, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and this week we're going to start our month-long discussion of Richard III with a quick look at the opening speech. Plus, we're going to have a film review of the Shakespeare-related Me and Orson Welles, and we'll do our usual recap of this week's blog entries. So, Richard III, the second longest play in the canon, only Hamlet's longer, one of the most famous, one of the greatest. The opening soliloquy is iconic, and perhaps after the to-be-or-not-to-be and Friends, Roman, Countrymen speeches, the most well-known. The role has been a flame for many an acting moth. An incredible challenge, mentally, the sheer number of lines, over 1,100, emotionally, the mixture of charm and evil, and physically, that damned hunchback plus the withered arm and, for some actors, a club foot. So let's take a listen at some performances of that famous opening speech. First up, we have Laurence Olivier, who in 1955 wrapped up his trilogy of Shakespeare adaptations with Richard III. In the film, he delivers the speech looking right at the camera, right at the audience. Here's how his opening sounded.
Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean, buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up for monuments, our stern alarums changed to merry meetings, our dreadful marches to delightful measures. Grim-visaged war has smoothed his wrinkled front, and now, instead of mounting barbed steeds to fright the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber, to the lascivious pleasing of a lute. But I, that am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking glass, I that am rudely stamped, and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph, I that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world, scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, love forswore me in my mother's womb, and for I should not deal in her soft laws, she did corrupt frail nature with some bribe to shrimp mine arm up like a withered shrub, to heap an envious mountain on my back, to shape my legs of an unequal size, to disproportion me in every part, like to a chaos, or an unlicked bare whelp that carries no impression like the damned. Why, I, in this weak piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time, unless to spy my shadow in the sun, and descant on mine own deformity. Then, since this earth affords no joy to me, but to command, to check, to o'erbear such as are of better person than myself, I'll make my heaven to dream upon the crown. And whilst I live, to account this world but hell, until this misshaped trunk that bears this head be round impaled with a glorious crown. But yet I know not how to get the crown, for many lives stand between me and home, and I like one lost in a thorny wood that rends the thorns and is rent with the thorns, seeking a way and straying from the way, not knowing how to find the open air, but toiling desperately to find it out, torment myself to catch the English crown, and from that torment I will free myself, or hew my way out with the bloody axe! Why? I can smile, and murder whilst I smile, and cry content to that which grieves my heart, and wet my cheeks with artificial tears, and frame my face to all occasions. I'll drown more sailors than the mermaid shall. I'll play the orator as well as Nestor, deceive more slyly than Ulysses could, and like a Sinon take another Troy. I can add colors to the chameleon, change shapes with Proteus for advantages, and set the murderous Machiavel to school! Can I do this, and cannot get a crown? Tut, were it further off, I'll pluck it down.
Now, while there's an aristocratic lilt to the voice, it's not bombastic. It's more personal than some of the others we'll hear. And note how he adds sections from Richard's revelation of his ambition from the third part of Henry VI throughout his opening speech, allowing him to give more background to his villainy and to play with the structure of the first act of the play of Richard III. Now next up, we have Paul Daneman in his BBC Shakespeare's An Age of Kings series from 1960.
Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house, in the deep bosom of the ocean buried, now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up for monuments, our stern alarums changed to merry meetings, our dreadful marches to delightful measures. Grim-visaged war hath smoothed his wrinkled front, and now instead of mounting barbed steeds to fight the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasing of a lute. But I, that am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking glass, I that am rudely stamped and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph, I that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I hold by them. Why, I, in this weak, piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time, unless to see my shadow in the sun, and descant on mine own deformity. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these fair, well-spoken days, I am determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasures of these days. Plots have I laid, inductions dangerous, by drunken prophecies, libels, and dreams, to set my brother Clarence and the king in deadly hate the one against the other. And if King Edward be as true and just as I am, subtle, false, and treacherous, this day should Clarence closely be mewed up about a prophecy which says that G of Edward's heirs, the murderer, shall be. Dive thoughts down to my soul. Here Clarence comes.
Now this opening has Richard excluded from a royal party. Visually, the speech is more to himself, right up to the point where he says that he will descant on his own deformity. At this point, he turns his attention and the speech to the audience. But he's not making an alliance with them. No. He's still very aristocratic, superior to them. Okay, so now let's move on to the 1980s with 1983's BBC Collected Works series with Ron Cook as Richard III.
Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up for monuments, our stern alarums changed to merry meetings, our dreadful marches to delightful measures. Grim-visaged war hath smoothed his wrinkled front, and now, instead of mounting barbed steeds to fright the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasing of a lute. But I, that am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking glass, I that am rudely stamped and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph, I that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world, scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, I, in this weak piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time, unless to spy my shadow in the sun and descant on my own deformity. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these farewell spoken days, I am determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasures of these days. Plots have I laid, inductions dangerous, by drunken prophecies, libels, and dreams, to set my brother Clarence and the king in deadly hate the one against the other. And if King Edward be as true and just as I am subtle, false, and treacherous, this day should Clarence closely be mewed up about a prophecy which says that G of Edward's heirs the murderer shall be. Dive thoughts down to my soul, here Clarence comes.
Now this is very naturalistic, performed straight to the camera and audience. The speech is less iconic, less aristocratic. And when he gets to the plots part of the speech, the tone becomes very conspiratorial. He takes us from being a friend to a co-conspirator. It's nicely effective. We also have the English Shakespeare Company's production of The War of the Roses with Andrew Jarvis from 1989.
Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this sun of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean, buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up for monuments, our stern alarums changed to merry meetings, our dreadful marches to delightful measures. Grim-visaged war hath smoothed his wrinkled front, and now instead of mounting barbed steeds to fright the souls of fearful adversaries, capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasing of a lute. Not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking glass. Either am rudely stamped, and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph. Either am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature. Deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world, scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, I, in this weak, piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time, unless to spy my shadow in the sun and descant on my noon deformity. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these farewell spoken days, I am determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasures of these days. Plots have I laid. Inductions dangerous by drunken prophecies, libels, and dreams to set my brother Clarence and the king in deadly hate the one against the other. And if King Edward be as true and just as I am subtle, false, and treacherous, this day should Clarence closely be mewed up about a prophecy which says that G of Edward's heirs, the murderer shall be. Thy thoughts down to my soul, here George comes.
Now this production begins in a fairly public setting, thus the jazz on stage. Jarvis is very aristocratic in his performance, reveling in all those rolling R's. At the change of tone, however, at lute, he draws a curtain that cuts him off from the onstage band and leaves him alone with the audience. And from there, it's playfulness, bringing the comic aspects of Richard's character to life. Now, less comic, though, is the opening from the Ian McKellen-Richard Longcrane film from 1995.
Is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths. Our bruised arms hung up for monuments. Our stern alarums changed to merry meetings. Our dreadful marches to delightful measures. Grim-visaged war has smoothed his wrinkled front. And now, instead of mounting barbed steeds to fight the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasing of a lute. But I, that am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking glass, I that am rudely stamped, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world, scarce half made up. And that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, in this weak piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time. To spy my shadow and the sun and descant on mine own deformity. Why, I can smile and murder while I smile, and wet my cheeks with artificial tears and frame my face to all occasions. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover, I'm determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasures of these days. Plots have I laid to set my brothers, Clarence and King Edward, in deadly hate, the one against the other.
Now here, too, the speech is delivered to a royal audience, bombastic and politic, right up to adversaries. At which point, the speech turns low and sarcastic, as we find him going into the men's room to finish the speech. His edition of sections from Henry VI Part 3, particularly the murder whilst I smile part, are delivered to the restroom mirror. When we get to the plots have I laid, McKellen's Richard then beckons us to follow him out of the restroom. He has made his connection with us, whether we want it or not. Now we have an audiobook snippet with Kenneth Branagh from 2002.
Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean bedded. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, Our bruised arms hung up for monuments. Our stern alarums changed to merry meetings. Our dreadful marches to delightful measures. Grim-visaged war hath smoothed his wrinkled front, and now, instead of mounting barbed steeds to fright the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasing of a lute. But I, that am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking-glass, I that am rudely stamped, and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph, I that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them, why I, in this weak, piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time, unless to see my shadow in the sun and descant on mine own deformity. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these fair, well-spoken days, I am determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasures of these days. Plots have I laid, inductions dangerous by drunken prophecies, libels, and dreams, to set my brother, Clarence, and the king in deadly hate the one against the other. And if King Edward be as true and just as I am subtle, false, and treacherous, this day should Clarence closely be mewed up about a prophecy which says that G of Edward's heirs the murderer shall be. Dive thoughts down to my soul. Here Clarence comes.
Here the clip opens with the click, click, click of his leg brace hitting the ground as he walks the stage. Again, we get the aristocratic vibe, but it's clearly to the audience, an audience with whom he can reveal his bitterness. Just listen to the dripping anger as he discusses his deformities. He spits out those words. Now, I've always been a big Kenneth Branagh fan, and this is just nicely done. Now, finally, we have Jonathan Slinger from the 2007 Royal Shakespeare Company production.
Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house, in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up for monuments, our stern alarums changed to merry meetings, dreadful marches to delightful measures, grim and visaged war hath smoothed his wrinkled front. And now, instead of mounting barbed steeds to fright the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasing of a lute. I am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking-glass. I got a rudely stout! And want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph. I that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world, scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, I, in this weak, piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time, unless to spy my shadow in the sun, and descant on my own deformity. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these fair, well-spoken days, I'm determined to prove a villain and hate
the idle pleasures of these days. Plots have I laid, abductions dangerous, by drunken prophecies, libels, and dreams, to set my brother Clarence and the king in deadly hate, the one against the other. And if King Edward be as true and just as I am subtle, false, and treacherous, this day should Clarence closely be mewed up about a prophecy which says that G of Edward's heirs...
Now in the video for this, we see him opening the speech to Prince Edward, an unseen but accompanying royals. The opening is bombastic, over the top, just bordering on sarcasm. And he sends the boy off just before he gets to the I section of the speech. And then he's talking to us, only us. The bombastic aspect is gone. Only the anger is left. His hmm, after deformed, is obviously a reach out to the audience for a connection. And the connection is made. From bombast to anger to a simple matter-of-fact statement of villainy. He has brought us in, past layers of performance, to what he really is at his core, a villain. This is a great performance. So there you have it, 7 actors, multiple ways of playing the role. It's a pretty neat exercise looking at the opening speech this way. Now many, but not all, damn you Criterion, are available on YouTube. And I'll post links to them on this podcast's blog page at thebillshakespeareproject.com. A couple of days back, I checked out the new film Me and Orson Welles by Richard Linklater. It depicts a one-week period in November of 1937 as Orson Welles prepares to open his stage version of Julius Caesar on Broadway. A young actor named Richard Samuels, played by Zac Efron of High School Musical fame, happens upon a gathering of the acting company outside the theater and in a stroke of luck finds himself cast in the small role of Lucius. We follow him as the show goes through its final rehearsals and past opening night. Now, over the course of that week, he witnesses Welles at work, falls in love with the production assistant Sonia Jones, played by Claire Danes, who 14 years ago played Juliet to DiCaprio's Romeo in Baz Luhrmann's adaptation, and finally learns, to his chagrin, the cutthroat aspects of professional theater. But at the center of this universe, both of the story and the Wonderkind's mind itself, is Orson Welles, who is all of 22 years of age at the time. He had already made a name for himself in radio at age 20 and directed himself in a radio version of Hamlet at 21, and he had already directed the WPA production that was dubbed Voodoo Macbeth earlier in 1937. We see the brilliance of Welles, which is astonishing, and it's matched by his charm. But both of these are no match, however, to his arrogance. It's no wonder that Citizen Kane would be the first and only time Welles would work in Hollywood. There is no way the studio system would have allowed such an autocrat to succeed. Now, Christian McKay brings Welles to life. Voice, face, bearing, all spot on. We're astounded by his arrogance, but his genius makes it okay. Then we're astonished by his arrogance, but his charm lets him get away with it. Had he been only a genius, or only charming, his ego would have overwhelmed them. But since he had so much in reserve, both charm and genius, he's able to survive. Now Claire Danes, as the ambitious and very modern careerist, is wonderful, both charming and cunning. And Efron is solid as the audience surrogate. He's charming enough for us to feel good and supportive about him, but naive enough to make us fear for him. And the other supporting actors, playing real-life actors from Joseph Cotten to Norman Lloyd to John Houseman, are also very, very good. The script by Holly Gent Palmo and Vincent Palmo, based on the novel by Robert Kaplow, is light and straightforward, and it is directed by Robert Linklater in a mode more akin to his work on Before Sunset than of his work in the more popular School of Rock. The film is in limited release, so you probably won't get a chance to see it on the big screen. But that's okay. It's an intimate story that will work well on the screen at home, and it's definitely worth a rental when you get the opportunity. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries this week, you've missed out on subjects including, and the story of Henry VI is the story of who? Numbers, midpoint. The third part of Henry VI by the numbers overall. Memories of things to come. A look back at our first year, and Act 1, Scene 1, Inductions Dangerous. So, if you would like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com, or you can become a fan of our Facebook page. Now remember, the Facebook page is more for Shakespeare news than the daily discussions of our play of the month. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, please join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 3rd, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.